This evening, we have not one, but two speakers. We have Bruce and Lynn from Valencia this evening. And it is my pleasure to introduce them and offer them the microphone.
Thank you. Am I okay on the mics, Jack? Okay. Hi, everybody. My name is Bruce Angelet, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm an enthusiastic alcoholic. And I wasn't enthusiastic when I got here, believe me. When I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I had no hope left. No hope that it was ever going to get better, that anything was ever going to change. You know, I would wake up, come to, out of blackouts, various places, and each time it was the same. I had no hope that it was ever going to get any better. You know, and if there are any new folks in here or alcoholics in the room tonight, my only wish for you is that you be as desperate as I was when you got here. Because once we're that desperate, we have a chance of making it here. And the only thing that's going to make me or any other alcoholic desperate is alcohol. You know, nobody can say anything to me. Nobody could tell me this or point to me and say this or that. Until I'm ready, until alcohol is done with me. And if I'm lucky enough to be alive and desperate enough, then maybe I have a chance. I ended up a lot of years ago at a psychiatrist's office. I had been seeing him for years. And he thought that at that day, they thought that alcoholism was a Valium deficiency. And so they may still do, that's true, yes. And so I was introduced to the blue pills and then the yellow pills, and it didn't get any better. It got worse, and it was insanity. So this doctor finally said to me, well, if you be alcoholic, and maybe you are, he said, the medical profession can't help you. If you have a chance of making it, it's with Alcoholics Anonymous. I suggest you call them. And for whatever reason, it was my time, because I decided to call Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't have a lot of time tonight to go into a lot of the background and how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Suffice it to say, I went to my meeting. I was was confused. It was in a dark room. It was up on a stage behind the curtain over in West L.A. And later found out it was called a step study meeting. And they pointed to this black, which I thought was a black book. It turned out it was a blue book, but they called it the blue book. And, you know, they kept mentioning God, and I kept cringing. And you know, when I heard all that, I just felt it's not going to work for me. I had tried God, I tried church, and nothing did it good a job of relieving me from those feelings that I had than alcohol did. And so I knew it wasn't going to work for me. I knew it wasn't going to take those feelings away. But yet something happened at my first or second meeting, because while I was at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt safe. I felt like I wasn't this totally hopelessly alone, and like I felt day after day, night after night, when I came to from drinking and taking those wonderful Valiums or whatever else I was taking at the time. And you know, and I went to my second meeting, and a couple of guys welcomed me, and they said, Bruce, come on in. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you know, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I didn't really know what an alcoholic was. I mean, I knew my father was an alcoholic, but I didn't know that I was an alcoholic. I didn't believe that. And for those of you that get to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and don't believe you're alcoholic, don't worry about it. My experience is that it's contagious, and you catch alcoholism if you go to enough Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And that is my experience. If you go to enough meetings and you're hurting bad enough, sooner or later you'll get to the place like I did, where I look back and said, oh my God, how could I possibly have thought that I wasn't an alcoholic? How could I possibly thought that? Blackout after blackout. I had started having blackouts the first year I drank, you know, and I drank for 18 years. And you know, and I a blackout, for those of you that don't know, is different from passing out. Passing out means you just plop down and you had too much to drink and you're out. A blackout is when your brain shuts off. It's the best I can describe it. If I were still drinking, I could be here talking to you tonight just as I am, not making any sense, but talking to you, and it would be, my head would shut off, and I would not remember that I was here, that I spoke to you, or that any of you were here, you know? And that happened to me night after night, you know? And the next morning is real hard work, you know? Like trying to pretend when my wife would say something to me about the show we watched last night or something, trying to remember, what show did we watch? What the hell is she talking about? How do I ask it so that she'll know, that she'll tell, give me the information I need so I don't have to look like I don't know, you know? And this happened night after night, day after day. I go to work after having been out with the people from work on the weekend, and, you know, and people are saying, God, you really had a good time Friday. Do you remember what you did? And I'd smile, oh, yeah, yeah. I didn't have a clue what the hell I did, you know? And that was the scary part of the blackout, you know? And I continued to have them, and yet I continued to have those feelings, you know? And what led me to drink alcohol, and what alcohol did for me is it took away those feelings that I'm different and I don't fit in and I don't belong here. And, you know, and I always felt that way. I felt that way from the time I was a kid, you know? I always felt like it was gonna be better later. It's gonna be better somewhere else, you know? It's gonna be better. If I'm over here, it's gonna be better if I go over there, you know? And I had that feeling that it was never okay when I was, where I was, and who I was, no matter what situation, in school, in social situations, in a marriage, it didn't matter. I just knew that the problem was me. You know, I knew it was me. I didn't need to be convinced of that. I knew it was me. And when I drank, it dulled those feelings. I didn't have to feel them anymore. Now, of course, every time I had a sober moment or a wakeful moment, you know, I had those feelings were right back there again. And now on top of it was the guilt that I had. You know, why don't I remember? Why can't I do it? And I'm sharing this with you so that if you're not familiar with what the ugliness of alcoholism is, that's what it is from the inside of an alcoholic, you know? And a lot of what I'm sharing with you, I learned when I got here. Because if you'd have asked me just before I got here, are you an alcoholic? I would have said no. I did not have a clue that I was an alcoholic, or I could not see that reality, you know? It took a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous for me to realize that, oh my God, yes, that's my problem. And I didn't want to admit that because if I did, then my solution to my feelings would go away, you know? And I knew I couldn't do it without alcohol. Now, I came in July, and my first thought was when I finally found out that I wasn't going to be able to drink anymore was, oh my God, how am I going to make it through Labor Day? You know, or how am I going to make it through Thanksgiving? You know, those were big worries for me. You know, how the hell am I going to do that? I couldn't get out of bed in the morning without having a drink, you know? My dependency had become so great. Everything I did, the fear was so great, the only way I could deal with it is to drink some more alcohol, you know? And what happened is, after I drank long enough, what happened is I got to the place after 18 years where I was waking up or coming to, like I shared with you, where I no longer had any hope that it was ever going to get better, you know? And what happens, and in my book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about the place, the point of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. To me, what that meant was, I always had this childlike hope that it was going to get better. No matter how bad it was, how much trouble I was in, where I was, it's going to get better. Later, next year, next girl, next, always going to get better. Until I got to that place, and I wish that for any alcoholic in this room tonight, that you get to that place where you no longer think it's ever going to get any better. And then we become teachable. And then we can come to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, if it be God's will to get us here. And I don't know that for anybody else, you know. I've been around for quite a number of years now, and I've seen people come in and I've seen people go out, you know. And why am I still here? I have no idea. I certainly don't deserve it any more than anyone else, you know. I didn't do anything wonderful to earn sobriety. You know, I've gone to a lot of meetings, yes. I've tried to help other people, yes, I've done all that. But I really don't think I did anything to deserve it. So I have come to the conclusion that this God that I've come to understand here in Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the gift of sobriety, has taken away that obsession that today I can drink and today it's going to be okay, you know. And I don't know if that's ever going to come back, you know. So I have to deal with this thing, and that's why we say this is a one day at a time program, because that's what it is. Because I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, you know. I ask God each day to keep my alcoholism, to give it to him, take my disease and keep it, you know, and I'm hoping that it won't come back. But what anything that I can really do about it is try to carry the message and go help somebody, you know. For me, the whole program boils down to that, you know. No matter what's going on in my head, no matter how big the fear gets, you know. And I'm a very fearful person. The first thing I do when I wake up in the morning, or worse, at 4 o'clock in the morning, is I'm full of fear. Oh, my God, how am I going to do this? I won't know how to call this guy. I won't know how to handle this customer. This guy's going to be mad at me. You know, he told me I did a good job today, but tomorrow he's going to tell me I did a lousy job, and I'll probably get fired, and blah, 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 blah. And the fear gets built up, and, you know, and here it is 4 o'clock in the morning. What the hell do I do about it, you know? And or I get up in the morning. And that's today. That's not 30 years ago or so when I got here. That's today, you know? So I have basically, in that regard, I haven't changed. I'm a frightened little boy in an old person's body, you know? And maybe that'll change after 32 years, or I don't know. But for 31 years and some days, it has not changed, you know? But you all, thank you guys, you have given me some tools to deal with that. As soon as I can remember, and sometimes it takes me a longer time than others, as I can remember to think about someone else, or to think about doing something for someone else, the fear immediately goes away. Isn't that amazing how that works, you know? If I can think about, my wife Lynn is here and she's going to share in a few minutes, but if I can think about, well, gee, I wonder if I could help her with something, you know? She's been having a problem, so maybe I could help her. Maybe I could throw the clothes in the dryer. Whatever it is, the trick for me is to think about someone else. The fear goes away. You know, carry this and take this in all of our affairs, means at home, at work, not just with another alcoholic or another member of Al-Anon. It's a way I have to live if I want to be relatively free from the bondage of self and full of that fear, you know. And what a gift. You know, I had no idea when I got here that was ahead of me, you know. I saw doom and gloom, a bunch of old people with, you know, trench coats and brown paper bags and, you know, and kind of like a temperance thing. And, you know, I had no idea, you know. When I got here, you know, there were, you know, recovery programs weren't around, you know. When I first got here, we actually went on 12-step calls. You know, I was here about 6 months, and this fellow Larry, who I knew from Pacific Group, called me up and said, "Bruce, we got a 12-step call. I'll be over to get you." And I had no idea what he was talking about. You know. But I've learned to say, "Okay, I'm ready. We'll go." We got into his car. We went over and picked this guy up in this dilapidated motel. Scared the hell out of me, you know. But Larry looked like he knew what the hell he was doing, so I went along with him, and you know. And we get this guy in the car, and he was in bad shape. And we were taking him down to the hospital in Long Beach, to the Naval Hospital, because he was a military type. And so we put him in the car, and we're on the San Diego freeway heading down that way. And the guy has a convulsion sitting between the two of us. And he becomes rigid, and he has his foot on top of Larry's gas on the accelerator. And fortunately, Larry knew what to do. He put the car in neutral and signaled, and we moved over. But, I mean, that's some scary stuff. And we take this guy down to this hospital in Long Beach, and we put him there, and, you know, and coming back, I was a different person. I was a different person because I was willing, for whatever reason, to go do something for someone else. I was a different person. I had this feeling inside of me. And I've had this feeling repeated time and time again over the years when I go out on a panel, you know. I've gone on a lot of H&I panels, and H&I, for those who don't know, is where we take meetings to people who are confined and can't get out to meetings. And I've been to probably hundreds of meetings over the years, or whether I've answered the phones at central office. And, you know, these are all things that I did that allowed me to get that feeling inside of me that, for me today, is how I come to know this power greater than myself, you know. I used to pray to a God up there, you know, when I finally got to that place in my service. When I got for here first, I didn't pray at all. I mean, except when I was desperate and said, "God, help me." But, you know, I would pray to a God up there, you know, and you know, in fact, when I first got here and somebody said, well, get down on your knees and thank God today for being sober. And I lived alone in a big old house, you know, and yet I don't kneel. I was brought up in a Protestant church. Catholics don't kneel. We don't. Anyhow, I closed the drapes to make sure nobody could see me. And I lived alone now, right? No dog, no cat, nothing. And I got down on my knees and I asked God. I said, thank you for this day of sobriety. And you know, and you've let me discover this power greater than me. So if you're coming here and this God thing sounds scary or something that's impossible for you, don't worry about it. Just keep coming. If you come into these rooms and you are, you may be an alcoholic, don't worry, you'll become one. You know, I promise you that. Or you'll go out and drink some more, and then maybe you'll be convinced if you're lucky enough to get back. And you know, I'm truly blessed because I have such an enthusiasm and appreciation for Alcoholics Anonymous that I wish I could give to the people that are new. You know, I wish I could infuse you or inject you with the enthusiasm, the experiences that I've had here. The discoveries that have come to me because I was willing to reach out and say, I don't know, help me. I think that's the most important words that any of us can say in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon. I don't know, please help me. That's when I can start getting better, or when I started getting better. And I still have to do that. I don't have enough ego. I don't let the ego control me from not getting to that place today. It may take a while. I may have to bang my head on the wall a little bit for a while. I don't want to stand up here and have you think that I'm wonderful or that I have the answers to everything. I don't. I'm as human as anybody else in this room. But I've had enough experiences now and have been through enough things, both good and bad, to know that no matter what, it's going to be okay. No matter what, I'm not going to pick up a drink today. I may drink tomorrow, but I'm not going to pick up a drink today. And the rest of it has happened to me. You know, in God's time, things happen. But we have to be here. We have to be doing. We have to be involved. Because it positions us to be ready to receive it when we get the information and when it's time for us to have it. I'll give you a couple of for instances and then I'm going to stop because my time is up. Two examples. One is my father. My father was the alcoholic who I was terrified of, who when we sat down to dinner, I would eat as fast as I could to get out of there before it happened. You know. And I dreaded that night after night. In fact, it got so bad for me that I used to sit down at the dinner table and I would get nosebleeds because the fear was so great, you know. So I know what it's like to be on the other side of it too, to be with an alcoholic father. And I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and I would share from the podium when I was asked to share. And I would mention about my father and my anger toward him would just well up inside of me. And this would happen my first year, second year, third, fourth, fifth year. It was as though I had just left my father's house, you know, and my father died back in 1961, you know, long before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it seemed strange to me that why I had so much of this anger. And, you know, we come here and we talk about these things, we share about them. And when it's time, one evening we were standing, Lynn and I and Milton were standing on the landing of our home, and all of a sudden we were talking about this, and I mentioned this, and all of a sudden, it came to me, is that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I did my inventory and I made my amends and you reminded me that I need to put my name on the list because I didn't choose to be an alcoholic. You know, I have a disease. I'm not a moral leper. You said that you have a disease and you didn't choose to be an alcoholic. And all of a sudden it realized that I was carrying this anger around toward my father. And all of a sudden I realized that, oh my God, he no more wanted to be an alcoholic, Bruce, than you did. He no more wanted to be an alcoholic than you did. And given that piece of information, I was able to let go of that anger and that resentment and to make my amends to him for that anger that I carried around, you know. And these are the types of gifts that we that are here for us when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the other one was with my mother. I would cheer from the podium. And if my mother never came, I would talk about my story and nothing ever came out of my mouth about my mother, you know? And I could, it seemed to me strange, why not? I talk about my father, nothing came. And we shared about it and talked about it, and all of a sudden, when it was time, all of a sudden I had this vision of back home in New Jersey, in our house. It's a Saturday night, and we're in our kitchen, and up one end of the kitchen is my father and my mother, and down the other end is me, kind of cowering in the corner, right? And my father is getting ready to storm out of the house, and my mother is saying, "Bill, don't go, you know, stay here, don't go, don't leave us." And I'm in this corner cowering, and my feeling was, why don't you stop him? Why are you letting him do that to us? And I had so much anger toward my mother that I didn't realize that I was carrying around. And I was able, armed with that information, to be able to be free of that too. So, you know, these are the kind of gifts we get here. So if you're new to this thing, just keep coming back. And it's the best show in town. And I tell you, it's something to behold. And I wish you all a good evening. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Lynn Angelette, and I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon, and I'm definitely the fast talker in the family, so you got to listen fast, because I only got 20 minutes, and I'm one of those pit bulls. I've been around a long time. And I'm very grateful. You know, my husband shared that he gets up at 4:30 or 5 in the morning and he's full of fear. And as soon as he can be of service, he is feeling better. So he gets up every morning and goes to Noah's and gets me a bagel and coffee. So I'm glad I could be of service and get you out of your fear, hun. I did not grow up with any alcoholism. I've chosen all my alcoholics. Thank you very much. My story is like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. My ex-husband never drank, and he was too boring. And I went to a practicing alcoholic, and he was too exciting. And then I found Bruce, and he was sober, and he was just right. So. I grew up with Cinderella, and all I wanted to do was be the fairy princess, and I wanted all of you to be my Prince Charming to take care of my life, and so I didn't have to do anything, and that's not how it worked out. And when I was very black and white as a child. I followed all the rules, and that was the way, and I was a people pleaser. I was good in school. I just wanted to please my parents and get on with my life. And my mother told me when I was when I started dating, you find a man of your same religion that's going to be a professional, and you marry him, and you'll be happy the rest of your life. Now, she may have mentioned something about love, but I realized in this program I have selective hearing. I hear what I want to hear. That's what I heard. So this poor boy, when he was 16 and I was 15 and a half, he asked me out on a date, and I took him hostage for the next 10 years because he fit those qualifications. I manipulated it. We went to high school together. We went to college together. We got married, and we're going to live happily ever after. We were married about a year and a half. This is the part of the story I don't like to tell, and I met the practicing alcoholic, and I made my ex-husband's life so miserable that he asked me for a divorce. And I got to look like the very sweet, innocent person. And, you know, I'm grateful to say that I've made amends to that man. And when I called to make amends to him, and my sponsor said, "You just tell him you're sorry for your part in the breakup of your marriage. You don't mention anything else about the other man because you're not going to hurt him anymore." And when I said that, he said, "You know, we were young. You don't owe me an amends." But then he said, "You know, the hurt goes away." And he was the first person that ever confronted me with the fact I could hurt somebody. I was so busy being the victim, it never occurred to me I was hurting other people. And I really had to walk a much straighter path since then. Also, his sister is in Al-Anon, and she got to hear my whole story. So the truth is out, and the truth does set you free. So anyway, so I went with this man, and I did not know anything about alcoholism. I thought you had to wear a trench coat and carry your bottle in a bag, and he wore a three-piece suit, and he worked at a bank, so how could he be an alcoholic? Now, it would have been too easy to find somebody that lived in Los Angeles, so I had to find one that lived in Houston, Texas. So when I call him and say, "You can't come out for the weekend," he'd say, "That's really bad news. I have to go to the 7-Eleven and buy some beer. I'll be right back." And he'd call me back, and I thought, oh, isn't he macho? And and he was a periodic. He would go for long periods where he'd be sober, and then he would go on these binges. And then I would have to figure out what I did in those 3 weeks to change him so he started drinking again. I did not know that I didn't cause this disease, and I can't control it, and I can't cure it. And I got insane in that relationship. I stayed up till 4 in the morning for him to come home so I could pretend I was sleeping so I wouldn't know I waited up. And then he would come in, and he would be hungry. And I would make him breakfast because I was so wonderful. But what it really was is that he would feel worse the next morning. I was really good at that manipulation. And I realized somewhere along the way that you don't have to be treated poorly before you're treated well. And that was the way our relationship went. I didn't mind how badly he treated me because I knew he would feel so guilty that he would treat me better later. And any violence that took place in that home was not him, it was me. He'd call my mother a four-letter word and I'd slap him in the face. I did insane things. We would go out on a date and we'd be 5 miles from the house and he would say something I didn't like and I'd say, "Stop the car, I'm getting out." And he would, and I did. And I'd walk home the 5 miles thinking he's going to wait there for me. He'd be going out, he'd go out and drink. He wasn't waiting there for me. And it just got insane. And my part was, you know, I stayed for 3 years. And every time I left, I thought I had the longest breakup in the history of the world until I heard how many times you guys said you were leaving and drove around the block and came back. Finally, you know, the pain of leaving was not as bad as the pain of staying, and I was ready to leave. My bottom with him was, well, actually, I stayed 6 months after this bottom, but we decided if we didn't live together and we lived separately, then we could just date and life would be fine. So I moved home to the San Fernando Valley with my parents, and we were going to his company Christmas party, and I don't know how the Alcoholics in Your Life party, but they had to go out to lunch first and start drinking. Then they had to I had to meet him at a bar afterwards so they could drink some more before we got to the party. We don't give advice in Al-Anon, but when you know someone's drank that much and they say, "Let me drive you," usually not a good idea, but I left my car at the bar, got down to the party. When he was so drunk that he fell in front of his bosses on the dance floor, we thought maybe it was time to leave. And he drove down by the beach. We were in Santa Monica. He told me to get out of the car one more time. It never occurred to me before Al-Anon I had choices. Never once did I think I could call my parents, I could call a friend, I could call a taxi. My best thinking said I had to walk back 26 blocks to my car. My best thinking and my ego also said I couldn't walk down Santa Monica or Wilshire because they're too well lit. Somebody might see me. So I picked the darkest street and I started walking. And I know that I have a higher power. I didn't believe in a higher power when I got here, but I know that night I did because this man pulled up and he asked me for directions and I didn't know where he needed to go and he made a U-turn and he said, "You're obviously in trouble and need to get to your car." He said, "I promise I won't touch you and I'll drive you to your car. The only thing I ask is I have another car that needs to be jump-started if you follow me over there." Indeed, I got in the car with that man. He drove me to my car. He had another car that needed to be jump-started. The only thing he ever did was ask him. He called me the next day at work to see if I got home okay. Now, even after all that, the first thing I did was drive over to that man's apartment to make sure he was okay, and he wasn't there, and I drove home, and my parents told me that he'd been arrested for drunk driving, and we had to go bail him out of jail, so I drove all the way back to Santa Monica and bailed him out of jail, and then when he got out, I didn't know anything about blackouts, and he said, "Why did you leave that party with the girl that I work with?" And I told him that's not what happened. When I told him what happened, he called me a liar in front of my parents. And I thought, this is done. I am done. So we drove home. It was like 2 in the morning. Got up at 4 in the morning, went to work because I can't miss work. And I knew it was all over until the next morning when he called me and said those 3 words, "I need you." So I was right back because I knew this time it was going to be different. I'm forever grateful that all this happened, though, because I moved home in November. And in January, my mother was killed in a car accident. And I had that time to make amends to my mother, and I was so angry. I was 25, and my mother had died, and I didn't know you were allowed to be angry. I thought there was something wrong with me because I was angry, so I just stuffed my feelings, and I went on. And through a series of other things, I had to take him to the hospital, and I chose to take him to the hospital, and he was diagnosed with hepatitis. And I remember those feelings of, and I think this is the hardest thing for me about living with an alcoholic. Those feelings of love and hate, because my first reaction when they told us he had hepatitis was, "Oh good, he won't be able to drink." And all and I felt so bad about myself that I loved this man, but I was glad he was sick. And a month later when he told me he could drink again, I believed him. I believed everything he told me. And finally, you know, God interceded, and the relationship ended. It wasn't anything dramatic. It was just, we both knew it was time. And then I met Bruce, and on our first date, he told me he was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my first thought was, this cannot be happening to me again. And, you know, I never thought I was good enough. And I know you probably couldn't tell, but Bruce is just a couple of years older than me. And so on our first date, I went out to buy a dress to make me look older. It never occurred to me he was looking for a young lady, not an old one. We were dating a month, and he did things like bring me flowers, pay for our dates. I asked him why he was so nice to me, and he said because I deserved it, and I never thought that. And you know, it was really interesting because when we were he didn't waste any time. When we were dating 3 months, he asked me to marry him, and I thought he was crazy. I dated my ex-husband 7.5 years, and he told me that 3 months in AA was a long-term relationship. But he also told me two things. He said that his sobriety would come first, and he would go to 3 to 5 meetings a week the rest of his life, and if I couldn't live with that, we couldn't get married. And he still does that. And the other thing he told me was that if God wanted us to be together, there was nothing I was going to do to mess it up. If God didn't want us to be together, there was nothing I was going to do to keep us together. And, you know, it took me 6 weeks to say yes, and it had nothing to do with Bruce. It had to do with the fact that I really thought if I married a nice man again, I'd screw him over like I did my ex-husband. I had a lot of fear about myself and my character after I did that to my ex-husband. So after 6 weeks, I said, well, why don't we get married next year? He said, well, if you've already decided, why don't we get married in August? And last week was our 26th wedding anniversary. And the best part is we still like each other. And you know, his sponsor's wife, God love Ruby, took me to my first Al-Anon meeting, and I was smug, arrogant, and self-righteous. They said that they didn't allow children at the meeting. I didn't have any children, but I already had a resentment. And and all I remember is this lady said, my husband dropped his socks on the floor, and I stepped over him and didn't pick him up. And everybody started clapping, and I thought, I must be in the wrong place, until we had a teenage child. Then I knew exactly what they were talking about. But I went 6 months till I went to my second meeting, and I realized I had all the stuff I thought would make me okay. I had the husband, I had the house, I had the job, and I still didn't like myself. And I went to a meeting, and God intervened, because went to this meeting at St. John's Hospital, and I thought they were all really old. They're younger than me now, but I thought they were all really old then. And I was only 27. I came in down on when I was 4. No. I sat here, and a lady sat right there, and I was a little arrogant. You know, Bruce had 4.5 years of sobriety, after all. And this girl sat across from me, and she was younger than me, and she said, my boyfriend has 4.5 years of sobriety. I've never seen him take a drink. And I went up to her after the meeting, and I said, are there meetings where there are younger people? And she was my Eskimo, because she said, Monday night I'll be in Marina Del Rey. I'll save you a seat. And Monday night I showed up. She goes, tomorrow night I'll be in Overland. I'll have you a seat. I showed up. Friday night I'll be at Chelsea and Wilshire. I'll have you a seat. You know what? You didn't need safe seats, but it was the first time anybody invited me to come to a meeting. And I went, and I was not one of those. I love those of you that say, I came down on, I felt at home. Not me. I was a hard nut to crack. I didn't know why I had to be there. And I would show up at 8 o'clock for an 8 o'clock meeting. I would leave at 9:31, and I couldn't figure out why you weren't very friendly. And then I'd go home, and I'd say to Bruce, how long do I have to go to these meetings? And he'd say, until you want to. And you know, I heard you say, get a sponsor, get a sponsor, get a sponsor. Now, this was my real thinking. If I get a sponsor that only has 6 months on the program, they won't ask me to do things like go to meetings and work the steps. So I did. And she was, you know what, I have to tell you, she was a perfect sponsor for me. She has a wonderful spiritual program to this day. When I called her once a month to check in, she was always very kind and loving to me, but I wasn't growing by leaps and bounds. Now, I was of service because I had learned that. So I did take a cookie commitment. I walked up and down the aisles. I did not know you don't fire the cookie person if they don't have the perfect cookies. It was like a food fantasy, you know, every time I went. But so I did that, and I went along, and then I had my first year birthday, and Bruce said, no self-respecting AA would have their first birthday without doing a fourth step inventory. And I said, well, in Al-Anon, we do it in our own way and pace. You know, I really knew I had grown in the program when every time we'd have an argument, I wouldn't say, well, maybe when I have 5 more years, I'll be as wonderful as you. Anyway, but when I had a little over a year in the program, I asked somebody to sponsor me who had 19 years in the program, who had a very different idea of sponsorship. Her favorite word was write. Call me back when you've written. We're going to work the steps from 1 to 12 without skipping 2 to 11 in the middle. And you know, I did all that. I wrote my four-step inventory, which was 120 pages of the most boring stuff you've ever heard in your entire life. The miracle is my sponsor did not fall asleep. The way she does it is she said, I have a list of character defects that came out of your inventory. I didn't think I had any character defects. And she read them to me and she said, are you entirely ready to have God remove these? Well, yeah, of course. People pleasing was one of them. So of course I'm ready. So we prayed and then she said, I also have a list of people you owe amends to. Oh, okay. So she gave me the list of amends and I started making my amends. And you know what? I have to tell you the real honest reason I finished my fourth step is I went to a meeting that every year did a step a month, and I thought I can't go back to the meeting and now have done my fourth step. And that was my real motive for doing it. You know, in the meantime, Bruce and I had decided when we were married a year, we were going to have a baby. And so we're married a year, and we didn't want to have a baby. So we asked everybody, how you know when it's time to have a baby? And they all said the same thing. When it's time, you'll know. And I really learned from that sometimes I can't make a decision because there's no decision to be made. And when we finally decided to have a baby, God had different plans. We went through major infertility treatment, and the people in these rooms laughed with us and they cried with us. And when I said I'm not going to do anything else, and I'd come back the next week with an intravenous needle in my arm with a pump attached on my waist, they loved me anyway. And the reason I say that is next Thursday night, which is a sharing meeting, somebody's going to say, I'm leaving my spouse, I'm leaving tomorrow. And then when they decide Friday not to leave, they think all week, how can I come back? My ego will let me come back. And you know what? We all say those things, and when you come back, and people love us anyway. And they loved us through the infertility treatment, and they loved us through adopting a baby, and they were all there, and they loved us through the mother taking that baby back. And they loved us through adopting our son we have today, because when that mother called and said she was coming to take the baby back, Bruce's sponsor Milton got to our house first, and he held us and he held the baby and he said the serenity prayer. And he said, God doesn't take something out of your life unless he's going to replace it with something better. But when you're in the hallway, it can be hell. And like my friend Jack would say, you have to put up some curtains and some wallpaper and make it look real pretty. And we did that, and we gave that baby back, and I didn't have my job anymore to make me okay, and I didn't have a baby to make me okay, and I was going to have to be okay on my own. And people in this program said, you keep on trying whenever you fail, and we went to another lawyer, and in October of 1986, we adopted our son, Jason, and you know what? He is better than the first. Those of you who have heard me speak when he was a teenager, I never didn't believe it then, but he is better than the first. And you know, when we went to that courtroom to have him legally become ours, we had all these program friends and the judge said, "What a nice looking group of people you have." And I thought, if she knew how many DUIs she had sitting in this room, she would die. And you know, my sponsor said to me when we had Jason that I would have to go to daytime babysitting meetings. And I said, you know what, they're not hip, slick, and cool during the day. And she said, someday you'll be grateful. And you know what, I was grateful. I got together with a group of women that we all had babies, and we would go to our meetings together, and then we'd take them to picnics in the park. And it was a grand 11 years. We had a lot of fun. We went to all the daytime meetings. Our kids all grew up together, and it was a lot of fun. And when Jason was 11, Bruce's business fell apart, and Bruce kept saying to me, oh, I know you'll know when it's time for you to go back to work. And I'm thinking, oh, I don't know. And you know, it became necessary for us to sell our house in West LA, and we moved out to Valencia, to the suburbs. You know, thank God for service, because when I got out there, I knew people. I knew Jack. I knew other people that went to meetings out there. So it wasn't that hard to transition. And it's great when you go to Valencia, because when they have fresh meat, you speak at every meeting in Valencia because they've never heard you before. So, you know, I got to do that. And those people walked me through going back to school. They walked me through graduate school. They walked me through my first day at my job. They did everything. They were there for me, and they showed me I could do more than I thought I was capable of doing for myself. And you know what? Then Jason became a teenager. And I have to tell you, I think I was a really good mother until Jason became a teenager. And my friend Z put it really well. She said, at some point, Jason's behavior outgrew my parenting skills. And our lovely house, you would not have known how much program we had, became a battle zone. And there would be screaming and yelling and swearing. And I felt like my insides and my outsides didn't match. I'd been around the program long enough. I knew the talk. But I'd go home, and we'd be having this battle. And we had to. My perfect straight-A student was flunking out of junior high school, and it became necessary for us to put him in a private high school. And I called my sponsor, and I said, we can't afford this. I don't know what we're going to do. And she said, did you pay this year's tuition? I said, yes. She goes, then you're going to do it 1 year at a time. And, you know, we did that. And it was really ugly in our house. And I would like to say it was all him. And his behavior was unacceptable, but I would get down and dirty there in the trenches. And I would get in the middle when he and Bruce were trying, when he and Bruce were fighting. And then Bruce, and then I would fight with him, and Bruce would get in the middle. And it was really, there were a lot of ugly, dark years in there. And somewhere along the way, I knew that spiritually I needed to do something different, that it wasn't working, and I had to go back, and I had to do another fourth step and become rigorously honest again and look at my part. And in 10th grade, I was the homework witch. I would yell at him, scream at him. I would do his homework for him. I would do everything. And one day in 10th grade, when he and I were having one more screaming fight, all of a sudden God intervened and said, you know what, even if this child goes to college, you're not going to have any relationship left with him. And I let go. And I remember going to a parent conference that year, and the teacher said, he's not turning this in. I said, you know what, that's between you and him, because if I get in the middle, it's not going to do any good. And I didn't have to say anything to him. And I learned to love that child unconditionally. I learned that he was more than just his academic work, that he really had a lot of goodness in him. And our relationship started to mend. And, you know, I do have to tell you this story that is funny in retrospect, was not so funny then. He was finally going to graduate from this private school, which God did give us the money to pay for every year. We're still paying for it now, and he's 22, but did give us the money to pay for it. And my whole family was coming from Utah and Nevada for his graduation, and we get a call Monday. He's graduating Thursday, that he owes three papers, and if he does not do them, he is not going to graduate. You know, when I called my family and I said, you know what, there may not be a graduation. If you want to still come out, we'll have a nice big dinner, but I don't know if he's graduating. He owes three papers. And my sister started yelling at me, write the papers for him so he graduates high school. And you know what, I have to tell you, my parents wrote my papers for me when I was in school. And then they always wanted to take credit for it. And I never felt good about myself. And you know what, when I was in graduate school, I wrote every one of those papers. And when I stood up and got that diploma, I knew what it felt like to earn my own diploma. And I said to my sister, he will either graduate on his own from high school or he will not graduate from high school. I am not writing a paper. So, Thursday, 3 hours before his graduation, Bruce gets a call from school. Oh, he turned him in. He didn't want you guys to know. He thought it was funny. So, and you know, I have to tell you, there were 12 kids in his graduating class, because there were only 70 kids, and it was like being in a meeting, because all these parents, these 12 sets of parents, had been through what we've been through. They knew what a big deal it was for him to graduate. And you know what? Our lives have really turned around, but I do have to tell one story. This is how God teaches me lessons. I like to have the last word. And so I had a new walking partner who was quite a bit older than me and never had any children, so never went through the teenage years. And we were going to walk for the first time, and she had like 4 years in the program, and I, Miss Wonderful, has 20-whatever years in the program, and the halo is over my head. And so she is, so Jason and I get in this rip-roaring argument, and I'm screaming at him, he's screaming at me, and I hear the doorbell ring, so I'm going to put on my happy Al-Anon face. You know, we always have to look good out in public. And as I'm walking down the stairs, I get this great idea that I should have the last word. So I yell something back up to him. So as I open the door to my lovely friend, he yells out, "Fuck you, Mom." And I just sat there. I never knew what I said. Years later, my girlfriend said, "Oh, you just said we'll talk about this later, honey." And but you know, the joy of the program is that I absolutely knew my part. I absolutely knew if I had not opened my mouth, he would not have said anything. And I absolutely knew my part. You have walked through everything with us. You have walked through my father living with us. You've walked through us having to change my father's diapers. You've walked through me having to tell the doctor with my brother to take my father off the machines and let him go. You were there for the funeral when Bruce's mom died, and I think God does for you what you can't do for yourself. Bruce's mom always wanted us to be in New Jersey for Christmas, and we were never there in New Jersey, and her funeral was on Christmas Eve, so we flew out and we were there for Christmas. But you know what, when we arrived in New Jersey, and you know, Bruce doesn't have a lot of acquaintances back there anymore, and we had family, and we walked in, and there was two things of flowers, one from Bruce's AA group, and one from one that said, and nobody could figure out who it was, my steel magnolias, who are my women that are there with me no matter where I am. And when Bruce had to have, when Bruce had an angiogram, and the doctor thought he was going to do angioplasty, and my girlfriends were sitting with me in the waiting room, and they came out and told us he was going to have 5 bypasses, my support group all started crying. I'm like, thank you very much. But you know what? They were there for me. I mean, the waiting room, we had Chinese food, we had alcoholics, we had Al-Anons, we had everything. And you know what? I remember they let us all in to see Bruce at once, and I remember everybody said he looked so good. I thought, what, compared to a corpse? And, you know, but you've been there. You've been through there through the good times and the bad times. And, you know, I walked in this room tonight, and there are women that I share with in this room. And, you know, you taught me I can be as selfish and self-centered as anybody. And you've taught me that I need to change my actions. I start my morning every morning. I'm a morning person. I'm also a night person. I don't sleep a lot. But, you know, I have 2 women I sponsor that have competition in the morning who can get me earlier at 6:30 in the morning, and one knows if they call and the line's busy, they did not win that morning. And you have women that and men that share with me at night. And I'm so forever grateful. And Danny, I don't know where you are, but thank you, my friend Danny, for asking us to share. And Nestor, thank you for helping me be humble when he said to me, "Well, God, if it was just you, Sharon, I don't want to hear you again, but I've never heard Bruce. I'll come with you guys." So, and to the newcomers, if you didn't hear anything tonight, see all these men here, come back next week and hear them, and keep coming back. Thank you.